Chapter 12, 1971, to the beginning of something yet to be determined. The chapter begins with two quotes. Firstly, from the 1984 film Repo Man, "Look at all these bums. If only there were a way of finding out how much they owe." And from the novel The Dispossessed by Ursula Le Guin, "Free your mind of the idea of deserving, of the idea of earning, and you will begin to be able to think." On August the 15th, 1971, U.S. President Richard Nixon announced that foreign-held U.S. dollars would no longer be convertible into gold, thus stripping away the last vestige of the international gold standard. This was the end of a policy that had been effective since 1931, and confirmed by the Bretton Woods Accords at the end of World War II, that while U.S. citizens might no longer be allowed to cash in their dollars for gold, all U.S. currency held outside the country was to be redeemable at the rate of $35 an ounce. By doing so, Nixon initiated the regime of free-floating currencies that continues to this day. The consensus among historians is that Nixon had little choice. His hand was forced by the rising costs of the Vietnam War, one that, like all capitalist wars, had been financed by deficit spending. The U.S. was in possession of a large proportion of the world's gold reserves in its vaults at Fort Knox, though increasingly less in the late 60s as other governments, most famously Charles de Gaulle's France, began demanding gold for their dollars. Most poorer countries, in contrast, kept their reserves in dollars. The immediate effect of Nixon's unpegging of the dollar was to cause the price of gold to skyrocket. It hit a peak of $600 an ounce in 1980. This, of course, had the effect of causing U.S. gold reserves to increase dramatically in value. The value of the dollar, as denominated in gold, plummeted. The result was a massive net transfer of wealth from poor countries, which lacked gold reserves, to rich ones like the U.S. and Great Britain that maintained them. In the U.S., it also set off persistent inflation. Whatever Nixon's reasons, though, once the global system of credit money was entirely unpegged from gold, the world entered a new phase of financial history, one that nobody completely understands. While I was growing up in New York, I would hear occasional rumors of secret gold vaults underneath the Twin Towers in Manhattan. Supposedly, these vaults contain not just the U.S. gold reserves, but those of all the major economic powers. The gold was said to be kept in the form of bars, piled up in separate vaults, one for each country, and every year, when the balance of accounts was calculated, workmen with dollies would adjust the stocks accordingly, carting, say, a few million in gold out of the vault marked Brazil and transferring them to one marked Germany, and so on. Apparently, a lot of people heard these stories. At least right after the towers were destroyed on September the 11th, 2001, one of the first questions many New Yorkers asked was, what happened to the money? Was it safe? Were the vaults destroyed? Presumably, the gold had melted. Was this the real aim of the attackers? Conspiracy theories abounded. Some spoke of legions of emergency workers secretly summoned to make their way through miles of overheated tunnels, desperately carting off tons of bullion, even as rescue workers labored overhead. One particularly colorful conspiracy theory suggested that the entire attack was really staged by spectators who, like Nixon, expected to see the value of the dollar crash and that of gold to skyrocket, either because the reserves had been destroyed or because they themselves had laid prior plans to steal them. The truly remarkable thing about this story is that after having believed it for years and then, in the wake of 9/11, having been convinced by some more knowing friends that it was all a great myth, "No," one of them said resignedly, as if to a child, "the United States keeps its gold reserves in Fort Knox." I did a little research and discovered that, no, actually, it's true. The United States Treasury gold reserves are indeed kept at Fort Knox. But the Federal Reserve's gold reserves? and those of more than 100 other central banks, governments, and organizations are stored in vaults under the Federal Reserve Building at 33 Liberty Street in Manhattan, two blocks away from the towers. At roughly 5,000 metric tons, that's 266 million troy ounces, these combined reserves represent, according to the Fed's own website, somewhere between one-fifth and one-quarter of all the gold that has ever been taken from the earth. The gold stored at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York is secured in a most unusual vault. It rests on the bedrock of Manhattan Island, one of the few foundations considered adequate to support the weight of the vault, its door, and the gold inside, 80 feet below street level and 50 feet below sea level. To reach the vault, bullion-laden pallets must be loaded into one of the bank's elevators and sent down 5 floors below street level to the vault floor. If everything is in order, the gold is either moved to one or more of the vault's 122 compartments, assigned to depositing countries and official international organizations, or placed on shelves. Gold stackers, using hydraulic lifts, do indeed shift them back and forth between compartments to balance credits and debits, though the vaults have only numbers, so even the workers don't know who is paying whom. There's no reason to believe, however, that these vaults were in any way affected by the events of September 11, 2001. Reality, then, has become so odd that it's hard to guess which elements of grand mythic fantasies are really fantasy and which are true. The image of collapsed vaults, the melted bullion, of secret workers scurrying deep below Manhattan, with underground forklifts evacuating the world economy, all this turns out not to be. But is it entirely surprising that people were willing to consider it? In America, the banking system since the days of Thomas Jefferson has shown a remarkable capacity to inspire paranoid fantasies. Whether centering on Freemasons, or Elders of Zion, or Secret Order of the Illuminati, or the Queen of England's drug money laundering operations, or any of 1,000 other secret conspiracies and cabals. It's the main reason why it took so long for an American central bank to be established to begin with. In a way, there's nothing surprising here. The United States has always been dominated by a certain market populism, and the ability of banks to create money out of nothing, and even more, to prevent anyone else from doing so, has always been the bugaboo of market populists, since it directly contradicts the idea that markets are a simple expression of democratic equality. Still, since Nixon's floating of the dollar, it's become evident that it's only the wizard behind the screen who seems to be maintaining the viability of the whole arrangement. Under the free market orthodoxy that followed, we've all been asked, effectively, to accept that the market is a self-regulating system, with the rising and falling of prices akin to a force of nature, and simultaneously to ignore the fact that in the business pages it is simply assumed that markets rise and fall mainly in anticipation of, or reaction to, decisions regarding interest rates by Alan Greenspan or Ben Bernanke, or whoever is currently the chairman of the Federal Reserve. One element, however, tends to go flagrantly missing in even the most vivid conspiracy theories about the banking system, let alone in official accounts. That is, the role of war and military power. There's a reason why the wizard has such a strange capacity to create money out of nothing. Behind him, there's a man with a gun. True, in one sense, he's been there from the start. I've already pointed out that modern money is based on government debt, and that governments borrow money in order to finance wars. This is just as true today as it was in the age of King Philip II. The creation of central banks represented a permanent institutionalization of that marriage between the interests of warriors and financiers that had already begun to emerge in Renaissance Italy, and that eventually became the foundation of financial capitalism. Nixon floated the dollar in order to pay the cost of a war in which, during the period of 1970-72 alone, he ordered more than 4 million tons of explosives and incendiaries dropped on cities and villages across Indochina, causing one senator to dub him the greatest bomber of all time. The debt crisis was a direct result of the need to pay for the bombs, or to be more precise, the vast military infrastructure required to deliver them. This was what was causing such an enormous strain on the US gold reserves. And many hold that, by floating the dollar, Nixon converted the US currency into pure fiat money, mere pieces of paper, intrinsically worthless, that were treated as money only because the United States government insisted that it should be. In that case, one could well argue that the US military power was now the only thing backing up the currency. In a sense, this is true, but the notion of fiat money assumes that money really was gold in the first place. Really, we're dealing with another variation of credit money. Contrary to popular belief, the US government can't just print money, because American money is not issued by the government at all, but by private banks, under the aegis of the Federal Reserve System. The Federal Reserve, despite the name, is technically not part of the government at all, but a peculiar sort of public-private hybrid, a consortium of privately owned banks, whose chairman is appointed by the US President with congressional approval, but which otherwise operates without public oversight. All dollar bills in circulation in America are Federal Reserve notes. The Fed issues them as promissory notes and commissions the US Mint to do the actual printing, paying it 4 cents for each bill. The arrangement is just a variation of the scheme originally pioneered by the Bank of England, whereby the Fed loans money to the US government by purchasing treasury bonds, and then monetizes the US debt by lending the money thus owed by the government to other banks. The difference is that while the Bank of England originally loaned the king gold, the Fed simply whisks the money into existence by saying that it's there. Thus, it's the Fed that has the power to print money. The banks that receive loans from the Fed are no longer permitted to print money themselves, but they are allowed to create virtual money by making the loans at a fractional reserve rate established by the Fed, though in the wake of the current credit crisis, at the time of writing, there has been a move to remove even these restrictions. All this is a bit of a simplification. Monetary policy is endlessly arcane, and it does sometimes seem intentionally so. Henry Ford once remarked that if ordinary Americans ever found out how the banking system really worked, there'd be a revolution tomorrow. What is remarkable for present purposes is not so much that American dollars are created by banks, but that one apparently paradoxical result of Nixon's floating the currency was that these bank-created dollars themselves replaced gold as the world's reserve currency, that is, as the ultimate store of value in the world, yielding the US enormous economic advantages. Meanwhile, the US debt remains, as it has been since 1790, a war debt. The US continues to spend more on its military than do all other nations on earth put together, and the military expenditures are not only the basis of the government's industrial policy. They take up such a huge proportion of the budget that by many estimations, were it not for them, the US would not run a deficit at all. The US military, unlike any other, maintains a doctrine of global power projection, that it should have the ability, through roughly 800 overseas military bases, to intervene with deadly force absolutely anywhere on the planet. In a way, though, land forces are secondary. At least since World War II, the key to US military doctrine has always been a reliance on air power. The US has fought no war in which it didn't control the skies, and it has relied on aerial bombardment far more systematically than any other military, in its recent occupation of Iraq, for instance, even going so far as to bomb residential neighborhoods of cities ostensibly under its own control. The essence of US military predominance in the world is, ultimately, the fact that it can, at will, drop bombs with only a few hours' notice at absolutely any point on the surface of the planet. No other government has ever had anything remotely like this sort of capability. In fact, a case could well be made that it is this very power that holds the entire world monetary system organized around the dollar together. And there's a chart of federal debt and the defense budget from 1950 to 2009. And they're both rising more or less together in a fairly exponential fashion. Because of US trade deficits, huge numbers of dollars circulate outside the country. One effect of Nixon's floating of the dollar was that the foreign central banks have little they can do with these dollars except use them to buy US Treasury bonds. This is what is meant by the dollar becoming the world's reserve currency. These bonds are, like all bonds, supposed to be loans that will eventually mature and be repaid. But, as economist Michael Hudson, who first began observing the phenomenon in the early 1970s, noted, they never really do. Quote, to the extent that these Treasury IOUs are being built into the world's monetary base, they will not have to be repaid, but are to be rolled over indefinitely. This feature is the essence of America's free financial ride, a tax imposed at the entire globe's expense. Unquote. What's more, over time, the combined effect of low interest payments and the inflation is that these bonds actually depreciate in value, adding to the tax effect, or as I preferred to put it in the first chapter, tribute. Economists prefer to call it seigniorage. The effect, though, is that the American imperial power is based on a debt that will never, can never, be repaid. Its national debt has become a promise, not just to its own people, but to the nations of the entire world, that everyone knows will not be kept. At the same time, U.S. policy was to insist that those countries relying on U.S. Treasury bonds as their reserve currency behaved in exactly the opposite way as they did, observing tight monetary policies and scrupulously repaying their debts. As I've already observed, since Nixon's time, the most significant overseas buyers of U.S. Treasury bonds have tended to be banks in countries that were effectively under U.S. military occupation. In Europe, Nixon's most enthusiastic ally in this respect was West Germany, which then hosted more than 300,000 U.S. troops. In more recent decades, the focus has shifted to Asia, particularly the central banks of countries like Japan, Taiwan, and South Korea, all U.S. military protectorates. What's more, the global status of the dollar is maintained in large part by the fact that it is, again since 1971, the only currency used to buy and sell petroleum. With any attempt by OPEC countries to begin trading in any currency stubbornly refused by OPEC members Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, also U.S. military protectorates. When Saddam Hussein made the bold move of single-handedly switching from the dollar to the euro in 2000, followed by Iran in 2001, this was quickly followed by American bombing and military occupation. How much Hussein's decision to buck the dollar really weighed into the U.S. decision to depose him is impossible to know, but no country in a position to make a similar switch can ignore the possibility. The result, among policymakers, particularly in the global South, is widespread terror. In all this, the advent of the free-floating dollar marks not a break with the alliance of warriors and financiers on which capitalism itself was originally founded, but its ultimate apotheosis, and neither has the return to virtual money led to a great return to relations of honor and trust. Quite the contrary. By 1971, the change had only just begun. The American Express card, the first general-purpose credit card, had been invented a mere 13 years before, and the modern national credit card system had only really come into being with the advent of Visa and MasterCard in 1968. Debit cards were later creatures of the 1970s, and the current, largely cashless economy only came into being in the 1990s. All of these new credit arrangements were mediated not by interpersonal relations of trust, but by profit-seeking corporations, and one of the earliest and greatest political victories of the US credit card industry was the elimination of all legal restrictions on what they could charge as interest. If history holds true, an age of virtual money should mean a movement away from war, empire-building, slavery, and debt peonage, whether waged or otherwise, and towards the creation of some sort of overarching institutions, global in scale, to protect debtors. What we've seen so far is the opposite. The new global currency is rooted in military power even more firmly than the old was. Debt peonage continues to be the main principle of recruiting labor globally, either in the literal sense, in much of East Asia or Latin America, or in the subjective sense, whereby most of those working for wages or even salaries feel that they are doing so primarily to pay off interest-bearing loans. The new transportation and communications technologies have just made it easier, making it possible to charge domestics or factory workers thousands of dollars in transportation fees and then have them work off the debt in distant countries where they lack legal protections. Insofar as overarching grand cosmic institutions have been created that might be considered in any way parallel to the divine kings of the ancient Middle East or the religious authorities of the Middle Ages, they have not been created to protect debtors, but to enforce the rights of creditors. The International Monetary Fund is only the most dramatic case in point here. It stands at the pinnacle of a great emerging global bureaucracy, the first genuinely global administrative system in human history, enshrined not only in the United Nations, the World Bank, and the World Trade Organization, but also the endless host of economic unions and trade organizations and non-governmental organizations that work in tandem with them, created largely under U.S. patronage. All of them operate on the principle that, unless one is the U.S. Treasury, one has to pay one's debts, since the specter of default by any country is assumed to imperil the entire world monetary system, threatening, in Addison's colorful image, to turn all the world's sacks of virtual gold into worthless sticks and paper. All true. Still, we're speaking of a mere 40 years here, but Nixon's gambit, what Hudson calls debt imperialism, has already come under considerable strain. The first casualty was precisely the imperial bureaucracy dedicated to the protection of creditors, other than those whose money were owed by the United States. The IMF policies of insisting that debts be repaid almost exclusively from the pockets of the poor were met by an equally global movement of social rebellion, the so-called anti-globalization movement, though the name is profoundly deceptive, followed by outright fiscal rebellion in both East Asia and Latin America. By 2000, East Asian countries had begun a systematic boycott of the IMF. In 2002, Argentina committed the ultimate sin. They defaulted, and got away with it. Subsequent U.S. military adventures were clearly meant to terrify and overawe, but they do not appear to have been very successful, partly because, to finance them, the U.S. had to turn not just to its military clients, but increasingly to China, its chief remaining military rival, after the near-total collapse of the U.S. financial industry, which, despite having been very nearly granted rights to make up money at will, still managed to end up with trillions in liabilities that it couldn't pay, bringing the world economy to a standstill, eliminating even the pretense that debt imperialism guaranteed stability. Just to give a sense of how extreme a financial crisis we're talking about, here are some statistical charts culled from the pages of the St. Louis Federal Reserve webpage. Here is the amount of U.S. debt held overseas, and there's a fairly exponential curve from 1970 up to about 2008, with a super exponential slope for the last 2-3 years. Meanwhile, private U.S. banks reacted to the crash by abandoning any pretense that we are dealing with a market economy, shifting all available assets into the coffers of the Federal Reserve itself, which purchased U.S. treasuries. And there's another chart which I won't describe, but it goes AWOL in 2009. Allowing them, through yet another piece of arcane magic that none of us could possibly understand, to end up, after an initial near $400 billion dip, with far larger reserves than they'd ever had before. And there's another chart from the St. Louis Federal Reserve. I don't know who's publishing these charts, by the way. I've seen them myself before and thought they are pretty alarming viewing. Is this part of the plan to just panic people? Or are they actually trying to communicate some useful information? I wasn't sure. At this point, some US creditors clearly feel they're finally in a position to demand that their own political agendas be taken into account. Quote,
China warns US about debt monetization. Seemingly everywhere he went on a recent tour of China, Dallas Fed President Richard Fisher was asked to deliver a message to Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke. Stop creating credit out of thin air to purchase US treasuries.
Unquote. Again, it's never clear whether the money siphoned from Asia to support the US war machine is better seen as loans or as tribute. Still, the sudden advent of China as a major holder of US Treasury bonds has clearly altered the dynamic. Some might question why, if these are really tribute payments, the United States' major rival would be buying Treasury bonds to begin with, let alone agreeing to various tacit monetary arrangements to maintain the value of the dollar and hence the buying power of American consumers. But I think this is a perfect case in point of why taking a very long-term historical perspective can be so helpful. From a longer-term perspective, China's behavior isn't puzzling at all. In fact, it's quite true to form. The unique thing about the Chinese Empire is that it has, since the Han Dynasty at least, adopted a peculiar sort of tribute system whereby, in exchange for recognition of the Chinese Emperor as world sovereign, they have been willing to shower their client states with gifts far greater than they receive in return. The technique seems to have been developed almost as a kind of trick when dealing with the northern barbarians of the steppes who always threatened Chinese frontiers, a way to overwhelm them with such luxuries that they would become complacent, effeminate, and unwarlike. It was systematized in the tribute trade practiced with client states like Japan, Taiwan, Korea, and various states of Southeast Asia, and for a brief period from 1405 to 1433, it even extended to a world scale under the famous eunuch admiral Zheng He. He led a series of 7 expeditions across the Indian Ocean, his great treasure fleet, in dramatic contrast to the Spanish treasure fleets of a century later, carrying not only thousands of armed marines, but endless quantities of silks, porcelain, and other Chinese luxuries to present to those local rulers willing to recognize the authority of the emperor. All this was ostensibly rooted in an ideology of extraordinary chauvinism. What could these barbarians possibly have that we really need anyway? But, applied to China's neighbors, it proved extremely wise policy for a wealthy empire surrounded by much smaller but potentially troublesome kingdoms. In fact, it was such wise policy that the US government, during the Cold War, more or less had to adopt it, creating remarkably favorable terms of trade for those very states, Korea, Japan, Taiwan, certain favored allies in Southeast Asia, that had been the traditional Chinese tributaries, in this case, in order to contain China. Bearing all this in mind, the current picture begins to fall easily back into place. When the US was far and away the predominant world economic power, it could afford to maintain Chinese-style tributaries. Thus, these very states, alone amongst US military protectorates, were allowed to catapult themselves out of poverty and into first world status. After 1971, as US economic strength relative to the rest of the world began to decline, they were gradually transformed back into a more old-fashioned sort of tributary. Yet China's getting in on the game introduced an entirely new element. There's every reason to believe that, from China's point of view, this is the first stage of a very long process of reducing the US to something like a traditional Chinese client state. And of course, Chinese rulers are not, any more than the rulers of any other empire, motivated primarily by benevolence. There's always a political cost, And what that headline marked was the first glimmerings of what that cost might ultimately be. All that I have said so far serves to underline a reality that has come up constantly over the course of this book, that money has no essence. It's not really anything. Therefore, its nature has always been, and presumably always will be, a matter of political contention. This was certainly true throughout the earlier stages of U.S. history, incidentally, as the endless 19th century battles between gold bugs, greenbackers, free bankers, bimetallists, and the silverites so vividly attest, or, for that matter, the fact that the American voters were so suspicious of the very idea of central banks that the Federal Reserve System was only created on the eve of World War I, 3 centuries after the Bank of England. Even the monetization of the national debt is, as I've already noted, double-edged. It can be seen, as Jefferson saw it, as the ultimate pernicious alliance of warriors and financiers. But it also opened the way to seeing government itself as a moral debtor, of freedom as something literally owed to the nation. Perhaps no one put it so eloquently as Martin Luther King, Jr., in his I Have a Dream speech, delivered on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in 1963.
In a sense, we've come to our nation's capital to cash a check. When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. This note was a promise that all men, yes, black men as well as white men, would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check which has come back marked insufficient funds.
One can see the great crash of 2008 in the same light, as the outcome of the years of political tussles between creditors and debtors, rich and poor. True, on a certain level, it was exactly what it seemed to be. A scam, an incredibly sophisticated Ponzi scheme designed to collapse in the full knowledge that the perpetrators would be able to force the victims to bail them out. On another level, it could be seen as the culmination of a battle over the very definition of money and credit. By the end of World War II, the spectre of an imminent working-class uprising that had so haunted the ruling classes of Europe and North America for the previous century had largely disappeared. This was because class war was suspended by a tacit settlement. To put it crudely, the white working class of the North Atlantic countries, from the United States to West Germany, were offered a deal. If they agreed to set aside any fantasies of fundamentally changing the nature of the system, they would be allowed to keep their unions, enjoy a wide variety of social benefits, pensions, vacations, health care, and, perhaps most important, through generously funded and ever-expanding public educational institutions, know that their children had a reasonable chance of leaving the working class entirely. One key element in all this was a tacit guarantee that increases in workers' productivity would be met by increases in wages, a guarantee that held good until the late 1970s. Largely as a result, the period saw both rapidly rising productivity and rapidly rising incomes, laying the basis for the consumer economy of today. Economists call this the Keynesian era, since it was a time in which John Maynard Keynes's economic theories, which already formed the basis of Roosevelt's New Deal in the U.S., were adopted by industrial democracies pretty much everywhere. With them came Keynes's rather casual attitude toward money. The reader will recall that Keynes fully accepted that banks do indeed create money out of thin air, and for that reason there was no intrinsic reason that government policy should not encourage this during economic downturns as a way of stimulating demand, a position that has long been dear to the heart of debtors and anathema to creditors. Keynes himself had in his day been known to make some fairly radical noises, for instance, calling for the complete elimination of that class of people who lived off other people's debts, the euthanasia of the rentier, as he put it, though all he really meant by this was the elimination through a gradual reduction of interest rates. As in so much of Keynesianism, this was much less radical than it first appeared. Actually, it was thoroughly in the great tradition of political economy, hearkening back to Adam Smith's ideal of a debtless utopia, but especially David Ricardo's condemnation of landlords as parasites, their very existence inimical to economic growth. Keynes was simply proceeding along the same lines, seeing rentiers as a feudal hangover inconsistent with the true spirit of capital accumulation. Far from a revolution, he saw it as the best way of avoiding one. Quote,
"I see, therefore, the rentier aspect of capitalism as a transnational phase which will disappear when it's done its work, and with the disappearance of its rentier aspect much else in besides will suffer a sea change. It will be, moreover, a great advantage of the order of events which I am advocating, that the euthanasia of the rentier, of the functionless investor, will be nothing sudden, will need no revolution." Unquote.
When the Keynesian settlement was finally put into effect after World War II, it was offered only to a relatively small slice of the world's population. As time went on, more and more people wanted in on the deal. Almost all of the popular movements of the period from 1945 to 1975, even perhaps revolutionary movements, could be seen as demands for inclusion, demands for political equality that assumed equality was meaningless without some level of economic security. This was true not only of movements by minority groups in North Atlantic countries who had been first left out of the deal, such as those for whom Dr. King spoke, but what were called national liberation movements from Algeria to Chile, or finally, and perhaps most dramatically, in the late 1960s and 70s, feminism. At some point in the 1970s, things reached a breaking point. It would appear that capitalism, as a system, simply cannot extend such a deal to everyone. Quite possibly it wouldn't even remain viable if all its workers were free wage laborers. Certainly it will never be able to provide everyone in the world the sort of life lived by, say, a 1960s auto worker in Michigan or Turin, with his own house, garage, and children in college. And this was true even before so many of those children began demanding less stultifying lives. The result might be termed a crisis of inclusion. By the late 1970s, the existing order was clearly in a state of collapse, plagued simultaneously by financial chaos, food riots, oil shock, widespread doomsday prophecies of the end of growth and ecological crisis, all of which, it turned out, proved to be ways of putting the populace on notice that all deals were off. The moment that we start framing the story this way, it's easy to see that the next 30 years, the period from roughly 1978 to 2009, follows the same pattern, except that the deal, the settlement, had changed. Certainly, when both Ronald Reagan in the United States and Margaret Thatcher in the UK launched a systematic attack on the power of unions, as well as on the legacy of Keynes, it was a way of explicitly declaring that all previous deals were off. Everyone could now have political rights, even by the 1990s, most everyone in Latin America and Africa, but political rights were to become economically meaningless. The link between productivity and wages was chopped to bits. Productivity rates have continued to rise, but wages have stagnated or even atrophied. And there's a chart of productivity and wages, and they're growing steadily between 1947 and mid-1970s. Productivity indeed continues to rise steadily. Wages are roughly static. This was accompanied at first by a return to monetarism, the doctrine that even though money was no longer in any way based in gold or in any other commodity, government and central bank policy should be primarily concerned with carefully controlling the money supply to ensure that it acted as if it were a scarce commodity, even as, at the same time, the financialization of capital meant that most money being invested in the marketplace was completely detached from any relation to production of commerce at all, but had become pure speculation. All this is not to say that the people of the world were not being offered something, just that, as I say, the terms had changed. In the new dispensation, wages would no longer rise, but workers were encouraged to buy a piece of capitalism. Rather than euthanize the rentier, everyone could now become rentier, effectively could grab a chunk of the profits created by their own increasingly dramatic rates of exploitation. The means were many and familiar. In the US, there are 401k retirement accounts and an endless variety of other ways of encouraging ordinary citizens to play the market, but at the same time encouraging them to borrow. One of the guiding principles of Thatcherism and Reaganism alike was that economic reforms would never gain widespread support unless ordinary working people could at least aspire to owning their own homes. To this was added, by the 1990s and 2000s, endless mortgage refinancing schemes that treated houses, whose value it was assumed would only rise, like ATMs, as the popular catchphrase had it, though it turns out in retrospect it was really more like credit cards. Then there was the proliferation of actual credit cards juggled against one another. Here, for many, buying a piece of capitalism slithered undetectably into something indistinguishable from those familiar scourges of the working poor, the loan shark and the pawnbroker. It didn't help here that in 1980, U.S. federal usury laws, which had previously limited interest to between 7% and 10%, were eliminated by an act of Congress. Just as the U.S. had managed to largely get rid of the problem of political corruption by making the bribery of legislators effectively legal, it was redefined as lobbying, so the problem of loan sharking was brushed aside by making real interest rates of 25%, 50%, or even in some cases, for instance for payday loans, 120% annually, once typical only of organized crime, perfectly legal, and therefore enforceable, no longer just by hired goons and the sort of people who have to place mutilated animals on their victims' doorsteps, but by judges, lawyers, bailiffs, and the police. Any number of names have been coined to describe the new dispensation, from the democratization of finance to the financialization of everyday life. Outside the US, it came to be known as neoliberalism. As an ideology, it meant that not just the market, but capitalism, I must continually remind the reader that these are not the same thing, became the organizing principle of almost everything. We were all to think of ourselves as tiny corporations, organized around that same relationship of investor and executive, between the cold, calculating math of the banker and the warrior who, indebted, has abandoned any sense of personal honor and turned himself into a kind of disgraced machine. In this world, paying one's debts can even come to seem the very definition of morality, if only because so many people fail to do it. For instance, it's become a regular feature of many sorts of business in America that large corporations or even some small businesses faced with a debt will almost automatically simply see what happens if they do not pay, complying only if reminded, goaded, or presented with some sort of legal writ. In other words, the principle of honor has thus been almost completely removed from the marketplace. As a result, perhaps, the whole subject of debt becomes surrounded by a halo of religion. Actually, one might even speak of a double theology, one for the creditors, another for the debtors. It's no coincidence that the new phase of American debt imperialism has also been accompanied by the rise of the evangelical right, who, in defiance of almost all previously existing Christian theology, have enthusiastically embraced the doctrine of supply-side economics, that creating money and effectively giving it to the rich is the most biblically appropriate way to bring about national prosperity. Perhaps the most ambitious theologian of the new creed was George Gilder, whose book Wealth and Poverty became a bestseller in 1981, the very dawn of what came to be known as the Reagan Revolution. Gilder's argument was that those who felt that money could not simply be created were mired in an old-fashioned, godless materialism that did not realize that just as God could create something out of nothing, his greatest gift to humanity was creativity itself, which proceeded in exactly the same way. Investors can indeed create value out of nothing by their willingness to accept the risk entailed in placing their faith in others' creativity. Rather than seeing the imitation of God's powers of creation ex nihilo as hubris, Gilder argued that it was precisely what God intended. The creation of money was a gift, a blessing, a channeling of grace, a promise, yes, but not one that can be fulfilled, even if the bonds are continually rolled over, because through faith, in God we trust again, their value becomes reality. Quote,
economists, who themselves do not believe in the future of capitalism, will tend to ignore the dynamics of chance and faith that largely will determine the future. Economists who distrust religion will always fail to comprehend the modes of worship by which progress is achieved. Chance is the foundation of change and the vessel of the divine. Unquote.
Such effusions inspired evangelists like Pat Robertson to declare supply-side economics the first truly divine theory of money creation. Meanwhile, for those who could not simply create money, there was a quite different theological dispensation. Debt is the new fat, Margaret Atwood recently remarked, struck by how much the advertisements that surround her daily on the bus in her native Toronto had abandoned their early attempts to make riders panic about the creeping terrors of sexual unattractiveness, but instead turned to providing advice on how to free oneself from the much more immediate terrors of the repo man. Quote, there are even debt TV shows which have a familiar religious revival ring to them. There are accounts of shopaholic binges during which you don't know what came over you and everything you spent was a blur, with tearful confessions by those who've spent themselves into quivering insomniac jellies of hopeless indebtedness and have resorted to lying, cheating, stealing and kiting checks between bank accounts as a result. There are testimonials by families and loved ones whose lives have been destroyed by the debtor's harmful behavior. There are compassionate but severe admonitions by the television host, who here plays the part of the priest or revivalist. There's a moment of seeing the light, followed by repentance and a promise never to do it again. There's a penance imposed. Snip, snip go the scissors on the credit card, followed by a strict curb on spending regimen. And finally, if it all goes well, the debts are paid down, the sins are forgiven, absolution is granted, and a new day dawns in which a sadder but more solvent man you rise the morrow morn. Unquote. Here, risk-taking is in no sense the vessel of the divine, quite the opposite. But for the poor, it's always different. In a way, what Atwood describes might be seen as the perfect inversion of the prophetic voice of Reverend King's I Have a Dream speech. Whereas the first post-war age was about collective claims on the nation's debt to its humblest citizens, the need for those who have made false promises to redeem themselves, now these same humble citizens are taught to think of themselves as sinners, seeking some kind of purely individual redemption, to have the right to any sort of moral relations with other human beings at all. At the same time, there is something profoundly deceptive going on here. All these moral dramas start from the assumption that personal debt is ultimately a matter of self-indulgence, a sin against one's loved ones, and therefore that redemption must necessarily be a matter of purging and restoration of ascetic self-denial. What's being shunted out of sight here is first of all the fact that everyone is now in debt, U.S. household debt is now estimated at, on average, 130% of income. And just as an aside, I presume 130% of income refers to 130% of annual income, a shorthand which I find to be very annoying because it's so inaccurate. I carry on. And that this very little of this debt has accrued by those determined to find money to bet on horses or toss away on fripperies. Insofar as it was borrowed, for what economists like to call discretionary spending, it was mainly given to children to share with friends, or otherwise to be able to build and maintain relations with other human beings that are based on something other than sheer material calculation. One must go into debt to achieve a life that goes in any way beyond sheer survival. Now, I can't let this go unremarked because I think this is an uncharacteristic lapse on David Graeber's part. It's a very forward-thinking and generally well-researched book, in my opinion, but on this point I know he's wrong because, as we heard on the show, there are people who don't use money. I spoke to somebody last December who said when he did get some money from an inheritance he was jolly glad to get shot of it because he felt weird buying things and he just preferred the moneyless gift economy life. So yeah, there's certainly a huge apparatus trying to get you into debt, but that isn't necessarily to say that you must go into debt to live a sociable life. Insofar as there is a politics here, it seems a variation on a theme seen since the dawn of capitalism. Ultimately, it's sociality itself that's treated as abusive, criminal, demonic. To this, most ordinary Americans, including black and Latino Americans, recent immigrants and others who were formerly excluded from credit, have responded with a stubborn insistence on continuing to love one another. They continue to acquire houses for their families, liquor and sound systems for parties, gifts for friends. They even insist on continuing to hold weddings and funerals, regardless of whether this is likely to send them skirting default or bankruptcy, apparently figuring that, as long as everyone now has to remake themselves as miniature capitalists, why shouldn't they be allowed to create money out of nothing too? Granted, the role of discretionary spending itself should not be exaggerated. The chief cause of bankruptcy in America is catastrophic illness. Most borrowing is simply a matter of survival, and if one doesn't have a car, one can't work, and increasingly, simply being able to go to college now almost necessarily means debt peonage for at least half one's subsequent working life. Still, it's useful to point out that for real human beings, survival is rarely enough, nor should it be. By the 1990s, the same tensions had begun to reappear on a global scale, as the older penchant for loaning money for grandiose state-directed projects like the Aswan Dam gave way to an emphasis on microcredit. Inspired by the success of the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh, the new model was to identify budding entrepreneurs in poor communities and provide them with small, low-interest loans. Credit, the Grameen Bank insisted, is a human right. At the same time, the idea was to draw on the social capital, the knowledge, the networks, connections, and ingenuity that the poor people of the world are already using to get by in difficult circumstances, and convert it into a way of generating even more expansive capital, able to grow at 5 to 20% annually. As anthropologists like Julia Eliachar discovered, the result is double-edged. As one unusually candid NGO consultant explained to her in Cairo in 1995, quote, "Money is empowerment. This is empowerment money. You need to be big. Need to think big. Borrowers here can be imprisoned if they don't pay, so why be worried? In America, we get 10 offers for credit cards in the mail every day. You pay incredible real interest rates for that credit, something like 40%, but the offer is there. So you get the card, you stuff your wallet full of credit cards, you feel good. It should be the same thing here. Why not help them to get into debt? Do I really care what they use the money for, as long as they pay the loan back?" Unquote. The very incoherence of the quote is telling. The only unifying theme seems to be, people ought to be in debt. It's good in itself. It's empowering. Anyway, if they end up too empowered, we can also have them arrested. Debt and power, sin and redemption, become almost indistinguishable. Freedom is slavery. Slavery is freedom. During her time in Cairo, Eliachar witnessed young graduates of an NGO training program go on strike for their right to receive startup loans. At the same time, just about everyone involved took it for granted that most of their fellow students, not to mention everyone else involved in the program, was corrupt and exploiting the system as their personal cash cow. Here, too, aspects of economic life that had been based on long-standing relations of trust were, through the intrusion of credit bureaucracies, becoming effectively criminalized. Within another decade, the entire project, even in South Asia where it began to appear suspiciously similar to the US subprime mortgage crisis. All sorts of unscrupulous lenders piled in, all sorts of deceptive financial appraisals were passed off to investors, interest accumulated, borrowers tried to collectively refuse payment, lenders began sending in goons to seize what little wealth they had, corrugated tin roofs, for example, and the end result has been an epidemic of suicides by poor farmers caught in traps from which their families could never possibly escape. Just as in the 1945-75 cycle, this new one culminated in another crisis of inclusion. It proved no more possible to really turn everyone in the world into micro-corporations or to democratize credit in such a way that every family that wanted to could have a house. And if you think about it, if we have the means to build them, why shouldn't they? Are there families who don't deserve houses? Than it had been to allow all wage laborers to have unions, pensions, and health benefits. Capitalism doesn't work that way. It's ultimately a system of power and exclusion. And when it reaches the breaking point, the symptoms recur, just as they had in the 1970s, food riots, oil shock, financial crisis, the sudden startled realization that the current course was ecologically unsustainable, attendant apocalyptic scenarios of every sort. In the wake of the subprime collapse, the US government was forced to decide who really gets to make money out of nothing, the financiers or ordinary citizens. The results were predictable. Financiers were bailed out with taxpayer money, which basically means that their imaginary money was treated as if it were real. Mortgage holders were overwhelmingly left to the tender mercies of the courts under a bankruptcy law that Congress had, a year before, rather suspiciously presciently, one might add, made far more exacting against debtors. Nothing was altered. All major decisions were postponed. The great conversation that many were expecting never happened. We live, now, at a genuinely peculiar historical juncture. The credit crisis has provided us with a vivid illustration of the principle set out in the last chapter, that capitalism cannot really operate in a world where people believe it will be around forever. For most of the last several centuries, most people assumed that credit could not be generated infinitely because they assumed that the economic system itself was unlikely to endure forever. The future was likely to be fundamentally different. Yet somehow, the anticipated revolutions never happened. The basic structures of financial capitalism largely remained in place. It's only now, at the very moment when it's becoming increasingly clear that current arrangements are not viable, that we've suddenly hit the wall in terms of our collective imagination. There is very good reason to believe that in a generation or so, capitalism itself will no longer exist. Most obviously, as ecologists keep reminding us, because it's impossible to maintain an engine of perpetual growth forever on a finite planet. And the current form of capitalism doesn't seem to be capable of generating the kind of vast technological breakthroughs and mobilizations that would be required for us to start finding and colonizing other planets. Yet faced with the prospect of capitalism actually ending, the most common reaction, even from those who call themselves progressives, is simply fear. We cling to what exists because we can no longer imagine an alternative that wouldn't be even worse. How did we get here? My own suspicion is that we're looking at the final effects of the militarization of American capitalism itself. In fact, it could well be said that the last 30 years have seen the construction of a vast bureaucratic apparatus for the creation and maintenance of hopelessness, a giant machine designed first and foremost to destroy any sense of possible alternative futures. At its root is a veritable obsession on the part of the rulers of the world, in response to the upheavals of the 60s and 70s, with ensuring that social movements cannot be seen to grow, flourish, or propose alternatives, that those who challenge existing power arrangements can never, under any circumstances, be perceived to win. To do so requires creating a vast apparatus of armies, prisons, police, various forms of private security firms, and police and military intelligence apparatus, and propaganda engines of every conceivable variety, most of which do not attack alternatives directly, so much as create a pervasive climate of fear, jingoistic conformity, and simple despair that renders any thought of changing the world seem an idle fantasy. Maintaining this apparatus seems even more important to exponents of the free market, even than maintaining any sort of viable market economy. How else can one explain what happened in the former Soviet Union? One would ordinarily have imagined that the end of the Cold War would have led to the dismantling of the army and the KGB and the rebuilding of factories. But in fact, what happened was precisely the other way round. This is just an extreme example of what has been happening everywhere. Economically, the apparatus is pure deadweight. All the guns, surveillance cameras, and propaganda engines are extraordinarily expensive and really produce nothing. And no doubt, it's yet another element dragging the entire capitalist system down, along with producing the illusion of an endless capitalist future that laid the groundwork for the endless bubbles to begin with. Finance capital became the buying and selling of chunks of that future, and economic freedom, for most of us, was reduced to the right to buy and sell a small piece of one's permanent subordination. In other words, there seems to have been a profound contradiction between the political imperative of establishing capitalism as the only possible way to manage anything, and capitalism's own unacknowledged need to limit its future horizons lest speculation, predictably, go haywire. Once it did, and the whole machine imploded, we were left in a strange situation of not being able to even imagine any other way that things might be arranged. About the only thing we can imagine is catastrophe. To begin to free ourselves, the first thing we need to do is to see ourselves again as historical actors, as people who can make a difference in the course of world events. And this is exactly what the militarization of history is trying to take away. Even if we are at the beginning of the turn of a very long historical cycle, it's still largely up to us to determine how it's going to turn out. For instance, the last time we shifted from a bullion economy to one of virtual credit money, at the end of the Axial Age and the beginning of the Middle Ages, the immediate shift was experienced largely as a series of great catastrophes. Will it be the same this time round? Presumably, a lot depends on how consciously we set out to ensure that it won't be. Will a return to virtual money lead to a move away from empires and of vast standing armies, and to the creation of larger structures limiting the depredations of creditors? There is good reason to believe that all these things will happen, and if humanity is to survive, they will probably have to. But we have no idea how long it'll take, or what, if it does, it would really look like. Capitalism has transformed the world in many ways that are clearly irreversible. What I've been trying to do in this book is not so much to propose a vision of what precisely the next age will be like, but to throw open perspectives, enlarge our sense of possibilities, to begin to ask what it would mean to start thinking on a breadth and with a grandeur appropriate to the times. Let me give an example. I've spoken of two cycles of popular movement since World War II. The first, 1945 to 1978, about demanding the rights of national citizenship. and the second, 1978 to 2008, over access to capitalism itself. It seems significant here that in the Middle East, in the first round, those popular movements that most directly challenged the global status quo tended to be inspired by Marxism. In the second, largely, some variation on radical Islam. Considering that Islam has always placed debt at the center of its social doctrines, it's easy to understand the appeal. But why not throw things open even more widely? Over the last 5,000 years, there have been at least two occasions when major, dramatic moral and financial innovations have emerged from the country we now refer to as Iraq. The first was the invention of interest-bearing debt, perhaps sometime around 3000 BC. The second, around 800 AD, the development of the first sophisticated commercial system that explicitly rejected it. Is it possible that we're due for another? For most Americans, it will seem an odd question, since most Americans are used to thinking of Iraqis either as victims or fanatics. That is how occupying powers always think about the people they occupy. But it's worthy of note that the most prominent working-class Islamist movement opposed to the US occupation, the Sadrists, take their name from one of the founders of contemporary Islamic economics, Muhammad Bakir al-Sadr. True, much of what has since come to pass for Islamic economics nowadays has proved decidedly unimpressive. Certainly, in no sense does it pose a direct challenge to capitalism. Still, one has to assume that among popular movements of this sort, all kinds of interesting conversations about, say, the status of wage labour must be taking place, or perhaps it's naive to look for any new breakthrough from the puritanical legacy of the old patriarchal rebellion. Perhaps it will come out of feminism, or Islamic feminism, or from some as yet completely unexpected quarter. Who's to say? The one thing that's clear is that new ideas won't emerge without the jettisoning of much of our accustomed categories of thought, which have become mostly sheer dead weight, if not intrinsic parts of the very apparatus of hopelessness, and formulating new categories of thought. This is why I spent so much of this book talking about the market, but also about the false choice between state and market that so monopolized political ideology for the last centuries that it made it difficult to argue about anything else. The real history of markets is nothing like what we've been taught to think it is. The earlier markets that we're able to observe appear to be spillovers, more or less, side effects of the elaborate administrative systems of ancient Mesopotamia. They operated primarily on credit. Cash markets arose through war, again, largely through tax and tribute policies that were originally designed to provision soldiers, but that later became useful in all sorts of other ways besides. It was only the Middle Ages, with their return to credit systems, that saw the first manifestations of what might be called market populism. The idea that markets could exist beyond, against, and outside of states, as in those of the Muslim Indian Ocean, an idea that was later to reappear in China with the great silver revolts of the 15th century. It usually seems to arise in situations where merchants, for one reason or another, find themselves making common cause with the common people against the administrative machinery of some great state. But market populism is always riddled with paradoxes, because it still does depend to some degree on the existence of that state, and above all, because it requires founding market relations, ultimately, in something other than sheer calculation, in the codes of honour, trust, and ultimately community and mutual aid, more typical of human economies. This, in turn, means relegating competition to a relatively minor element. In this light, we can see that what Adam Smith ultimately did in creating his debt-free market utopia was to fuse elements of this unlikely legacy with that unusually militaristic conception of the market behavior characteristic of the Christian West. In doing so, he was surely prescient. But like all extraordinarily influential writers, he was also just capturing something of the emerging spirit of his age. What we've seen ever since is an endless political jockeying back and forth between two sorts of populism, state and market populism, without anyone noticing that they were talking about the left and right flanks of exactly the same animal. The main reason that we're unable to notice, I think, is the legacy of violence that has twisted everything around us. War, conquest, and slavery not only played the central role in converting human economies into market ones, there is literally no institution in our society that has not been to some degree affected. The story told at the end of chapter 7 of how even our conceptions of freedom itself came to be transformed through the Roman institution of slavery from the ability to make friends, to enter into moral relations with others, into incoherent dreams of absolute power, is only perhaps the most dramatic instance and the most insidious, because it leaves it very hard to imagine what meaningful human freedom would even be like. If this book has shown anything, it's exactly how much violence it has taken over the course of human history to bring us to a situation where it's even possible to imagine that that's what life is really about, especially when one considers how much of our own daily experience flies directly in the face of it. As I've emphasized, communism may be the foundation of all human relations. That communism that, in our daily life, manifests itself, above all, in what we call love. But there's always some sort of system of exchange, and usually a system of hierarchy built on top of it. These systems of exchange can take an endless variety of forms, many perfectly innocuous. Still, what we're speaking of here is a very particular type of calculating exchange. As I pointed out in the very beginning, the difference between owing someone a favor and owing someone a debt is that the amount of a debt can be precisely calculated. Calculation demands equivalence. And such equivalence, especially when it involves equivalence between human beings, and it always seems to start that way, because at first human beings are always the ultimate values, only seems to occur when people have been forcibly severed from their contexts, so much so that they can be treated as identical to something else, as in 7 marten skins and 12 large silver rings for the return of your captured brother, 1 of your 3 daughters as surety for this loan of 150 bushels of grain. This, in turn, leads to that great embarrassing fact that haunts all human attempts to return to the market as the highest form of human freedom, that, historically, impersonal commercial markets originate in theft. More than anything else, the endless recitation of the myth of barter, employed much like an incantation, is the economist's way of fending off any possibility of having to confront it. But even a moment's reflection makes it obvious. Who was the first man to look at a house full of objects and to immediately assess them only in terms of what he could trade them for in the market, likely to have been? Surely, he can only have been a thief. Burglars, marauding soldiers, and then perhaps debt collectors, were the first to see the world this way. It was only in the hands of soldiers, fresh from looting towns and cities, that chunks of gold or silver melted down, in most cases, from some heirloom treasure, that like the Kashmiri gods or Aztec breastplates or Babylonian women's ankle bracelets, was both a work of art and a little compendium of history, could become simple, uniform bits of currency with no history, valuable precisely for their lack of history, because they could be accepted anywhere, no questions asked. And it continues to be true. Any system that reduces the world to numbers can only be held in place by weapons. whether these are swords or clubs, or nowadays so-called smart bombs from unmanned drones. It can only operate by continually converting love into debt. I know my use of the word love here is even more provocative in its own way than communism. Still, it's important to hammer the point home. Just as markets, when allowed to drift entirely free from their violent origins, invariably begin to grow into something different, into networks of honour, trust, and mutual connectedness, so does the maintenance of systems of coercion constantly do the opposite, turn the products of human cooperation, creativity, devotion, love, and trust back into numbers once again. In doing so, they make it possible to imagine a world that is nothing more than a series of cold-blooded calculations. Even more, by turning human sociality itself into debts, they transform the very foundations of our being, since what else are we, ultimately, except for the sum of relations we have with others, into matters of fault, sin, and crime, making the world a place of iniquity that can only be overcome by contemplating some great cosmic transaction to will annihilate everything. Trying to flip things around by asking, well, what do we owe to society, or even trying to talk about our debt to nature, or some other manifestation of the cosmos, is a false solution. Really just a desperate scramble to salvage something from the very moral logic that has severed us from the cosmos to begin with. In fact, it's, if anything, the culmination of the process brought to a point of veritable dementia, since it's premised on the assumption that we're so absolutely thoroughly disentangled from the world that we can just toss all other human beings, or all other living creatures even, or the cosmos, in a sack and then start negotiating with them. It's hardly surprising that the end result, historically, is to see our life itself as something we hold on false premises, a loan long since overdue, and therefore to see existence itself as criminal. Insofar as there's a real crime here, though, it's a fraud. The very premise is fraudulent. What could possibly be more presumptuous or more ridiculous than to think it would be possible to negotiate with the grounds of one's existence? Of course it isn't. Insofar as it is indeed possible to come into any sort of relation with the absolute, we're confronting a principle that exists outside of time, or human-scale time, entirely. Therefore, as medieval theologians correctly recognized, when dealing with the absolute, there can be no such thing as debt. Conclusion. Perhaps the world really does owe you a living. Much of the existing literature on credit and banking, when it turns to the kind of larger historical questions treated in this book, strikes me as little more than special pleading. True, earlier figures like Adam Smith and David Ricardo were suspicious of credit systems, but already by the mid-19th century, economists who concerned themselves with such matters were largely in the business of trying to demonstrate that despite appearances, the banking system really was profoundly democratic. One of the more common arguments was that it was really a way of funneling resources from the idle rich, who, too unimaginative to do the work of investing their own money, entrusted it to others, to the industrious poor, who had the energy and initiative to produce new wealth. This justified the existence of banks, but it also strengthened the hand of populists who demanded easy money policies, protections for debtors, and so on. Since, if times were rough, why should the industrious poor, the farmers and artisans and small businessmen, be the ones to suffer? This gave rise to a second line of argument, that no doubt the rich were the major creditors in the ancient world, but now the situation has been reversed. So Ludwig von Mises, writing in the 1930s, around the time when Keynes was calling for the euthanasia of the rentier, quote,
"Public opinion has always been biased against creditors. It identifies creditors with the idle rich and debtors with the industrious poor. It abhors the former as ruthless exploiters and pities the latter as innocent victims of oppression. It considers government action designed to curtail the claims of the creditors as measures extremely beneficial to the immense majority at the expense of a small minority of hard-boiled usurers. It did not notice at all that 19th century capitalist innovations have wholly changed the composition of the classes of creditors and debtors. In the days of Solon the Athenian, of ancient Rome's agrarian laws, and of the Middle Ages, the creditors were by and large the rich and the debtors the poor. But in this age of bonds and debentures, mortgage banks, saving banks, life insurance policies, and social security benefits, the masses of people with more moderate income are rather themselves creditors.
Unquote. Whereas the rich, with their leveraged companies, are now the principal debtors. This is the democratization of finance argument, and it's nothing new. Whenever there are some people calling for the elimination of the class that lives by collecting interest, there will be others to object that this will destroy the livelihood of widows and pensioners. The remarkable thing is that nowadays, defenders of the financial system are often prepared to use both arguments, appealing to one or the other according to the rhetorical convenience of the moment. On the one hand, we have pundits like Thomas Friedman celebrating the fact that everyone now owns a piece of Exxon or Mexico, and that rich debtors are therefore answerable to the poor. On the other, Niall Ferguson, author of The Ascent of Money, published in 2009, can still announce as one of his major discoveries that, quote, poverty is not the result of rapacious financiers exploiting the poor. It has much more to do with the lack of financial institutions, with the absence of banks, not their presence. Only when borrowers have sufficient access to efficient credit networks can they escape from the clutches of loan sharks. And only when savers can deposit their money in reliable banks can it be channeled from the idle rich to the industrious poor. Unquote. Such is the state of the conversation in the mainstream literature. My purpose here has been less to engage with it directly than to show how it has consistently encouraged us to ask the wrong questions. Let's take this last paragraph as an illustration. What's Ferguson really saying here? Poverty is caused by a lack of credit. It's only if the industrious poor have access to loans from stable, respectable banks, rather than to loan sharks or presumably credit card companies or payday loan operations, which now charge loan shark rates, that they can rise out of poverty. So actually, Ferguson is not really concerned with poverty at all, just with the poverty of some people.
Those who are industrious and thus do not deserve to be poor. What about the non-industrious poor? They can go to hell, presumably, quite literally, according to many branches of Christianity. Or maybe their boats will be lifted somewhat by the rising tide. Still, that's clearly incidental. They're undeserving, since they're not industrious. And therefore, what happens to them is really beside the point. For me, this is exactly what is so pernicious about the morality of debt, the way that financial imperatives constantly try to reduce us all, despite ourselves, to the equivalent of pillagers, eyeing the world simply for what can be turned into money, and then tell us that it's only those who are willing to see the world as pillagers who deserve access to the resources required to pursue anything in life other than money. It introduces moral perversions on almost every level. Cancel all student loan debt? But that would be unfair to all those people who struggled for years to pay back their student loans. Let me assure the reader that, as somebody who struggled for years to pay back his student loans, and finally did so, this argument makes about as much sense as saying that it would be unfair to a mugging victim not to mug their neighbours too. The argument might perhaps make sense if one agreed with the underlying assumption that work is by definition virtuous, since the ultimate measure of humanity's success as a species is its ability to increase the overall global output of goods and services by at least 5% per year. The problem is that it's becoming increasingly obvious that if we continue along these lines much longer, we're likely to destroy everything. That giant debt machine that has, for the last 5 centuries, reduced increasing proportions of the world's population to the moral equivalent of conquistadors, would appear to be coming up against its social and ecological limits. Capitalism's inveterate propensity to imagine its own destruction has morphed in the last half century, into scenarios that threaten to bring the rest of the world down with it, and there's no reason to believe that this propensity is ever going to go away. The real question now is how to ratchet things down a bit, to move toward a society where people can live more by working less. I'd like, then, to end by putting in a good word for the non-industrious poor. At least they aren't hurting anyone. Insofar as the time they're taking off work is being spent with friends and family, enjoying and caring for those they love, they're probably improving the world more than we acknowledge. Maybe we should think of them as pioneers of a new economic order that would not share our current one's penchant for self-destruction. In this book, I've largely avoided making concrete proposals, but let me end with one. It seems to me that we are long overdue for some kind of biblical-style jubilee, one that would affect both international debt and consumer debt. It would be salutary, not just because it would relieve so much genuine human suffering, but also because it would be our way of reminding ourselves that money is not ineffable, that paying one's debts is not the essence of morality, that all these things are human arrangements, and that if democracy is to mean anything, it is the ability to all agree to arrange things in a different way. It is significant, I think, that since Hammurabi, great imperial states have invariably resisted this kind of politics. Athens and Rome established the paradigm. Even when confronted with continual debt crises, they insisted on legislating around the edges, softening the impact, eliminating obvious abuses like debt slavery, using the spoils of empire to throw all sorts of extra benefits at their poorer citizens, who, after all, provided the rank and file of their armies, so as to keep them more or less afloat, but all in such a way as never to allow a challenge to the principle of debt itself. The governing class of the United States seems to have taken a remarkably similar approach, eliminating the worst abuses, e.g. debtors' prisons, using the fruits of empire to provide subsidies, visible and otherwise, to the bulk of the population, in the more recent years manipulating currency rates to flood the country with cheap goods from China, never allowing anyone to question the sacred principle that we must all pay our debts. At this point, however, the principle has been exposed as a flagrant lie. As it turns out, we don't all have to pay our debts. Only some of us do. Nothing would be more important than to wipe the slate clean for everyone, mark a break with our accustomed morality, and start again. What is a debt, anyway? A debt is just the perversion of a promise. It's a promise corrupted by both math and violence. If freedom, real freedom, is the ability to make friends, then it's also, necessarily, the ability to make real promises. What sorts of promises might genuinely free men and women make to one another? At this point, we can't even say. It's more a question of how can we get to a place that will allow us to find out. And the first step in that journey, in turn, is to accept that in the largest scheme of things, just as no one has the right to tell us our true value, no one has the right to tell us what we truly owe.